Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. On behalf of the Kaiser Family Foundation and CSIS, I'd like to welcome you here today to our conversation on the future of global health financing. I'm Jen Cates with the Kaiser Family Foundation. We're doing this event with CSIS, and Steve Morrison is there. I want to thank Steve and his team and my team here at Kaiser for helping us make this happen. As everyone knows, it would not happen without them. But we're very pleased to be able to do this today and to mark the release of IHME's latest analysis on development assistance for health, as well as accompanying analyses that they have coming out in The Lancet today that look more broadly at global health financing in the future. And as you all know, IHME, which is based at the University of Washington in Seattle, is the premier population health research center in the world and the organization that conducts the most rigorous analysis of global health financing that's out there that we all use and rely on and look forward to the release of these data every year. It provides such an important grounding for the consideration of the future of health financing in this current environment. And I also want to thank CSIS for kind of letting us get in on their show. They have been working with IHME for several years to have an event with them at the release, and kindly asked us to be part of it this year. So today we all join forces. And I think that's very apropos to the current circumstances we find ourselves in, which at best is marked by uncertainty, and at worst by potential retrenchment or receding engagement, despite the fact that the world grows more complex and interconnected every day. And while we'll hear about global trends for all governments, many of us in this room are, of course, thinking about the U.S. government and the work that it has been doing as the largest donor to global health in the world, and wondering about its future role and its positioning as the world looks ahead and what footprint it will have. While last year at this time, many of us were talking about the future of the U.S. global health engagement and thinking, after the election, we would expect to see changes at the margins and maybe a slowing of the pace, which had already started. I think what we all realize now is we're facing some challenges to the core and trying to understand what that all might mean. Some of this is evident by the budget, the skinny budget that was released by the administration recently, which talked very explicitly about the intention to cut foreign aid and aid spending next year. And while some signals were sent that global health would be protected relative to other areas, it's not clear that any area will be spared. For example, other budget documents that were released subsequently about this year called for nearer-term cuts, including to programs that have tremendous bipartisan support and history, such as PEPFAR. While the deep cuts proposed will likely not be realized at this level, Congress has already indicated its intention to push back, these should be looked at as clear policy statements about the future direction of the U.S. and do signal that there'll be many challenges ahead and a case to be made that all of you in this room will have to do to help everyone understand what the role of the U.S. going forward has, what it's been in the past and what it could be in the future. Because what does happen with the U.S. in this regard will have dramatic and potentially permanent implications for the world. And we'll hear a little bit about what that could be like today. The new data from IHME helps provide context for what this could mean for the health of the world, and particularly the health of those in the poorest countries and the poorest people, many of whom don't live in the poorest countries anymore, and what the role of development assistance for health, that is the external funding provided by donors, plays now and going forward. This will include analysis from IHME's flagship annual report, but as I mentioned, two new papers in The Lancet that came out today that are provocative and timely. And we've also asked IHME in preparation for today to take a look, if it could, at what some of the potential cuts by the U.S., if they were to happen, could mean for this longer trajectory as we go forward. So what we'll do, just to give you a sense of the run of our show today, we'll be able to hear from IHME from Dr. Joe Dielemann, who's the lead author of the Lancet papers and the IHME report. Then we'll have a panel discussion, and I'll introduce our panelists when we get to that point. And then we'll go to your Q&A. And I just want to let everyone know before the Q&A that the Q&A last year and the discussion that was had last year actually did contribute to IHME's thinking about the analyses that are coming out today. So this really is a dialogue, and I think it's all part of, we should all be thinking about what are the key questions that need to be answered. And I think IHME is uniquely positioned to try to help answer those. So thanks to them. So now I'm very pleased to be able to introduce Joe, who is the mastermind behind this work, this tremendous effort that I think his work on next year is probably started tomorrow, maybe it starts tomorrow. He's an assistant professor at IHME. He directs the tracking and analysis of development assistance for health, of health expenditure by disease, of government health funding, among many other things. He's been a great partner and thought leader in this area, and really, I think, a go-to resource for anyone who's working on health financing and trying to understand trends. So thank you, Joe. We're very happy to have you here today.
Thanks. Thanks, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much. So I'm just going to be giving kind of a quick summary, an introduction to the findings this year, so the research that was conducted over the course of the last year. Before I do so, I want to quickly thank a number of the folks that I worked with at IHME. There's a host of fellows, researchers, data analysts who really do the bulk of this work, and lots of blood, sweat, and tears. In some cases, literally go into this report, and thanks to them. Also, I want to draw your attention to what we're calling the Global Burden of Disease Health Financing Collaborator Network. That's a group of individuals. At this point, it's about 200 individuals that have contributed to this research. So many of them are actually authors on the research papers that were published today. And mostly I want to draw your attention to this because it's an open call. We're looking for more people to be a part of this. It's an opportunity for real experts in this space of global health finance to contribute, to provide feedback, to provide data, and to help think about what these analyses should be like in the future. So if that interests you, please follow the healthdata.org website and get more information. Thanks, of course, to our hosts today, the Kaiser Family Foundation and CSIS for the partnership, and of course to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that have funded the research today. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation has been doing research on global health financing over the last 8 or 9 years. This report that's coming out this year is our eighth. What makes this year's report distinct is that historically the first 7 reports focused on development assistance for health. So they focused on the financial and in-kind transfers from high-income countries through development agencies to low- and middle-income countries. That was kind of the main focus of what they were doing. We continue to do that in this year's report, but we added a chapter that really looks at the context in which those funds were received. So looking at a broadening the scope of what we're tracking. And that's a major part of what I'm going to talk about over the next 10 minutes, because it's really the novel, a major novel contribution to what we're publishing. So those are the two new reports that are coming out today, and I encourage you to pick one up in the lobby if you didn't get a chance. In addition, there's these two papers that really focus on the same topics. Both of the papers up here focus on development assistance for health and the context in which it was provided. The first paper, the big one up there, is kind of a state of global health finance at the moment and looking backwards. We think of that as the retrospective paper that focuses on the years 1995 through 2014. But then we also have our forecasting, our future of global health financing paper, which also came out yesterday, and focuses on the years 2015 to 2040. And essentially it paints a picture of what we expect health financing to be and starts to ask questions about how could there be changes? What are the policy options that could be levers to increase the resources available for health? So the few minutes I have are just looking at those papers essentially in sequential order, first a look backwards and then a look forward. Starting with a look backwards, this is a figure that might be foreign to many of you, but is actually a very simple concept. On the x-axis is economic development, measured by GDP per capita in this case, and the y-axis is total health spending. And what you see is this very positive exponential relationship between the two. As countries become wealthier, on average, they spend more on health. One thing that I'd like to draw your attention to in this figure is the major bend in the curve is right around $10,000 per capita. That's essentially, in rough terms, the distinction between middle income and high income. And so what we see is that many countries that are lower middle, or even upper middle income country are at the lower or the left side of this distribution and consequently spending a significant less on the health and health sector. The second point to point out related to the last couple years in health financing is asking the question of who's financing the healthcare spending. So what this figure does is it starts to break out the total health spending into these four different pieces. And to collectively, these four pieces add up to be the total health spending in each country. So there's the government spending, that's social health insurance in particular, in addition to regular government spending. There's prepaid private insurance, that's in the purple there. In the green is out-of-pocket spending, and lastly, in red, is development assistance for health. What you see when you look at this figure, which is essentially organized around an x-axis, again, of gross domestic product, is you see these kind of major stages. On the far left side of this figure, you see low-income countries that primarily depend on development assistance for health and out-of-pocket financing to pay for the health spending in those countries. If you go to the middle of the figure, closer to about 10,000, you see that development assistance has essentially become a smaller part of the health spending and been replaced, especially by out-of-pocket spending and now government health spending, a much larger share. And if you go to the far right, high-income countries, you see almost exclusively government spending. In many countries, we also have some private health spending, private insurance as well, and still a little bit of out-of-pocket spending. I would posit to you today that this is actually very consequential, because who's paying for healthcare actually really matters on the types of services that are purchased and who's actually getting the services that are being purchased. So it relates back to sustainability, of course, but also equity. And it's important to understand that there's some major trends associated with economic development. The third point is actually the most complicated. The third point says that despite being these global trends, there's an enormous amount of variation around these trends. And so right here, I have just an abbreviated part of one of the tables that we put in the first of these two papers. And it just looks at total health spending. The big number outside of the parentheses is the measurement for the income group as a whole. So just to make sure you get it, this just says that in high-income countries, across all of them, the spending per year is $5,221 per person. Now, what's in the parentheses is the country-specific range. So what we're saying is across all the high-income countries, there's one country, happens to be the Seychelles, that spends $853 per person. And then, of course, the United States on the other end of the spectrum at $9,237. So the point is that there's this enormous range of spending even within the high-income countries. And the important part is that variation exists across all of the income groups. So if we go down to the bottom, the low-income countries, which spend collectively $120 per person on health per year, the range is from $33, that's Somalia, to $347 per year, that's Uganda. So while the last slide talks about, really the last two slides, talks about these trends that are very robust and easily measured, this slide starts to talk about the amazing variation, and in some ways points to the opportunities that exist despite countries' status or kind of spot in the economic development. So you can make the entire table full, and you can start to see the variation that I just showed for total health expenditure exists for really all of the measurements that we're looking at. That if you're looking at domestic government spending, you still see major variation with different countries financing their healthcare systems in different ways and really focusing on different streams of financing. Moving to the future analysis, looking forward, this figure starts to look at how we expect there to be changes across time. So again, we're stratifying countries by the income groups that are based on the 2016 World Bank income groups. And we can see that the largest growth, that's the big bar on the top, in an increase in about $4,000 per person is in the high-income countries. So on the left side of that bar is the starting point, that's 2015, and the right side is what we expect high-income countries to be spending in 2040. So there's this increase of about $4,000 per person. When you can see in this case for the high-income countries, much of that growth we expect to be from government spending. So we expect the governments of the high-income countries to be spending even more on health by the time we fast forward to 2040. You can see that in the upper middle income countries, we also see amazing growth. We're expecting about $3,000 increase per person in spending over the next 25 years for upper middle income countries. It's important to juxtapose that with the lower middle income countries and the lower income countries, where we see much smaller growth, less than $1,000 increase in the lower middle income countries and less than $100 increase in the low income countries. The other important thing to recognize is that where the spending is increasing, and in many cases it's not nearly as much government spending, but it actually increases in out-of-pocket spending. Another way to think about this is just thinking about the population of the world. This is the distribution of where people live, again, based on income groups set in 2016. And what you can see in this figure is that much of the population growth is expected to be in low-income countries and lower middle-income countries. Those are countries that are currently in that economic group, that income group. If we now juxtapose that with health spending, we can see that a lot of the growth is actually in the upper middle income countries. And that while there's some increase, in particular in the lower middle income countries, it's certainly not commensurate with the population size. And now just to focus specifically on the low income countries and the lower middle income countries, you start to see this major juxtaposition on where people live and where health financing actually exists. Which really brings us to our last topic, which is to focus specifically on what is development assistance for health doing in this space and how does it impact this spending. So very quickly, to move over to our visualization, I'm hoping many people in the room are already familiar with this visualization. Essentially, it tracks development assistance from the source to the channel to the health focus area. Essentially, what is the resources being spent on? You can see that right now I have the screen set up to look specifically at 2016. And you can see in 2016, we estimate $37.6 billion of development assistance was dispersed. The United States is the biggest source of the funds, coming essentially from the US government, with about 34% of that. And we can see if we now look at the health focus areas, that HIV/AIDS in particular received the largest share of all the health focus areas that we're able to track. We can zoom into that and start to ask, what is the spending on HIV/AIDS specifically for? And we see the largest of those program areas within the HIV/AIDS health focus area is the treatment. This figure also still allows you to ask specifically where are the resources going. So right here, the drop-in screen looks at development assistance per capita. You can see the darker red is essentially more development assistance per capita. And if we want to draw your attention just to really the countries that are receiving the most development assistance, I've kind of grayed out everything below this point. And you can see that essentially above this space of about $2 per person, most of the spending is sub-Saharan Africa. The last screen that we focus on is our trends view, shows across time how this spending is taking place. We've commented many times about three distinct epochs in the disbursement of development assistance for health. In the 90s, the growth rate was just below 5%. Meaning every year there was 5% more development assistance than the previous year. In the first decade of the millennium, the growth rate went to 11%. So essentially the rate of increase more than doubled. And the last 6 years, from 2010 to 2006, the growth rate has actually been just below 2%. So we see a major change in the distribution, or essentially the growth in which development assistance is being added. It's important to recognize that while we're at $37.6 billion in 2016, one of the things that's changed recently is the health focus areas that are being prioritized. So HIV for many years has been the largest health focus area that we track. In 2016, it was $9.5 billion. I think one of the important takeaways of this research is we actually see a reduction in absolute terms. From 2010 to 2016, we have a reduction of $860 million, while development assistance for child health and maternal health and a couple of the other health focus areas have continued to rise. We can think about this as percent change as well and see that HIV/AIDS from 2010 to 2016 has had a reduction of about 8%. Switching over to the last couple slides is now thinking about development assistance in the future. Forecasting the amount of development assistance for health that's dispersed is tremendously difficult, and we spend a ton of time with it, and you get a figure that kind of looks like this, where you see about 2% onward growth, and you see this amazing uncertainty. And that's the reality of how much of this is actually just political economy, essentially governments and private donors determining that they want to provide resources for health. To give some context to this, we started to ask, well, what are some scenarios that could make this a little bit more concrete? So the first scenario that we said would be, what if the US had a 10% reduction in the amount of development assistance provided for the next budget, and then stayed constant at the next couple of years, or through 2040. What we see is that would lead a reduction from $68 billion down to $51 billion in 2040, and the gap here across these 25 years would be essentially $206 billion less for global health. We can juxtapose that with a scenario that said, what if the growth rate of U.S. spending or disbursement for development assistance had remained constant? So we said, what was the growth rate of the U.S. development assistance from 1990 through 2016, and it was about 7% growth. Had that 7% growth persisted, you'd actually see the green line. So the green line and red line aren't necessarily saying that this is what we expect to happen. It's meant to just provide some contextualizing of what this uncertainty interval actually looks like. And the really important takeaway, of course, is how important these decisions actually are. The red line is $206 billion less than that baseline, whereas the green line is $307 billion more across the 25-year period. So with that, I'm going to leave it to our distinguished panel and let them kind of talk through the decisions that actually lead to these different scenarios. So.
Okay, great. I'll call you up in a sec. Thanks, Joe. That was great. We talked a lot about what potential cuts could mean and or growth, and I think that will come out a little bit more in the panel discussion as well, what some scenarios could be. So I'm going to ask our panelists to come up in just a moment. I want to just tell you a little bit about them. There should be full bios. I'm not going to go into everything about them, but just very briefly, we have three individuals who've been working in this field for a very long time. Dr. Chris Murray, who directs and oversees IHME, and I was trying to think of how to say this. Are you the father, the grandfather, the parent of this field? Of work on all of these, on the global burden of disease, on health financing, on really trying to create a body of research that now has resulted in this that we all use, has long been working in this field for a long, long, many years, including at WHO and other institutions. We also have Dr. Tim Evans, who's currently the Senior Director of Health, Nutrition, and Population at the World Bank. We want to especially thank him for being here because, as you probably know, the World Bank is having its meetings right now, and he's coming away from those meetings to talk with us about this, and hopefully we'll bring some insight from what they're discussing there. Also has been working in this field for a very long time, again at WHO, Rockefeller Foundation, and many other institutions. And finally, Dr. Steve Morrison, who's the Senior Vice President at CSIS and Director of its Global Health Policy Center and a major partner of ours, a thought leader on global health and development. And in addition to his many years at CSIS, has worked at USAID, on the Hill, and other development locations. So we have three people, I think, who will provide unique and important takes on what this all might mean. We'll hear from them and then go to your questions. So I'll ask them to all come up.
Sit on the paper. There we go.
Great. Okay, so now the mics are all supposed to be working. Can you hear me? Great. So I'm going to first start with Chris. There's lots to unpack here. Joe did a really good job, I think, of succinctly providing what is a tremendous amount of information. I encourage everyone to look at the papers, to look at the reports. There's so much there to think about. What's your major takeaway for those of us sitting in the nexus? So there's advocates here, there's practitioners, there's policymakers, really trying to understand what's the long view? What should we be trying to think about or get to? Where should we be encouraged? Where should we be concerned?
So, no surprise. I think the first observation is that, back when the great financial crisis came along, everyone said development assistance for health is going to go way down. The IMF rightly pointed out it takes a long time for those things to work through the system. And we eventually did see the flattening out, and now we're at a point with both with the skinny budget and what Theresa May's announcement or lack of willingness to commit yesterday or today to the 0.7% in the UK, that there's a very real prospect that DAH will go down. So I think that will have lots of repercussions all across our community that work on global health and all the support that's both technical and financial that goes along with that. On the other side, you know, I think behind the scenes in what Joe showed is this sort of long-term 25-year view of how economies will evolve. And there's some really good news there, that the majority of the world by 2040 will live in high-income and upper-middle-income countries. But there'll still be 750 million people in low-income countries. And that's on current, you know, economic forecasts. That's a lot of people. And combine that with the that low-income countries, until, as Joe said, get up to sort of $10,000, don't really spend, haven't been spending a lot of their own resources. You end up in a situation where there'll still be tremendous need to support health programs in that particular 750 million that will be in low-resource settings.
One of the things that we started to see from the slides was this issue of what happens if there's this 10% cut, which may or may not be the case. We certainly don't know. But what if it, you know, one question that comes up, and I wonder, I know you'd have to crunch the numbers, but what if it was worse than that? What if it wasn't just a 10% cut next year, but it was a 10% cut next year, and then a 10% cut again, and then a 10% cut again? That may, again, may or may not happen, but when do we get to a free fall, in a sense, that really puts us, one might say it's in a crisis for what this could mean? And I know I'm asking you to speculate, but please do.
Oh, I don't know when we get to the free fall, but, you know, think about that chart that we all, the sort of iconic chart that we have in each of these reports, which is we've actually had almost continuous growth. And there's been a little up and down in 2011 to 12, but, you know, there hasn't been this period where there's a contraction or sustained contraction. And I think that it'll be hard to know what sort of knock-on that effect that has on, for example, willingness to finance the things like Gavi and Global Fund and mechanisms that have been highly successful at having impact.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's turn to Tim. You've come from the World Bank's meetings, which are underway, and also a UHC meeting that's underway. Given the conversations happening there, and now you're seeing the data here, what can you tell us about what you're hearing and what the bank is thinking about in terms of its role going forward, and how to really stimulate and encourage development assistance, as well as, I would just add, maybe more domestic resource mobilization, since we saw in the charts very clearly that the issue of out-of-pocket spending kind of being a predominant, playing a much more predominant role in countries as they're transitioning, and that could put a burden on people. What, I know that's a big question, but
Sure. Well, first, let me begin by congratulating Joe and colleagues, because I think there's massive value in looking at the big picture. And I think sometimes in health, and in every sector, we're down in the weeds and we lose sight of the big picture, not only at the moment, but also prospectively. And as you can see, there are large confidence intervals in terms of what that future looks like. But for me, there's some hugely important messages coming out of that. The first is the health economy globally is going to more than double in size, from $9 to $24 trillion. And as a share of the global product, I'm sure it will increase as it has over time. And so why is that important? It's important because in all of the hype and hyperbole about automation and everyone's going to lose their job, it's unlikely the health sector will end up being automated. And in that respect, this is a massively important employment sector. And we've already got very strong evidence from the OECD countries where, in fact, the health and social sectors grow much faster as sources of employment than other sectors. And so I think one of the big messages here is that the health sector will continue to be globally a massively important, decent employer. And I think this is something that we really need to think about, because health is a virtuous sector insofar as it, one, improves health, but it also is a major productive investment sector and a decent employer. And when I say decent, it's in part because of the strong gender balance and increasing gender balance that we're seeing in the types of workers. So that's one big message. The second, though, and this is a little bit more concerning from the perspective of the World Bank, is the disparities in health spend are likely to grow. And that's where we're going to see the upper income and higher middle income countries increase their spending, and very concerningly, low income countries showing very little significant growth in the foreseeable future. And that means that we're going to have a greater gradient than we have already. And that draws attention to the outstanding need, especially when we look at the decomposition of that spending over time, which is largely out-of-pocket spending, and which we know is both inefficient and inequitable. The third big picture issue is really the very humbling but real recognition that development assistance in health is not much more than a drop in the bucket. And for us who are in the development business, that makes us feel a little small. But when you look at $37 billion out of $9 trillion now, in real numbers, the health development assistance is very small as an overall proportion of the global economy. Now, if you bring this down to low-income countries, we know that, in fact, it can be as much as 25 to 50% of domestic spend. And that's absolutely non-trivial and important. But I think it relates to, if you move up over time, that we need to really be rethinking development assistance from a provider of services and generator of results that will give taxpayers some sense of return of investment as the primary or only value proposition, to a value proposition which is actually development assistance is catalyzing the strengthening of domestic resource mobilization and the institutions that are necessary to move inefficient and inequitable spending, which is primarily out of pocket, to pooled and prepaid spending. And why do I say this? When you look at the current spend in many low-income countries and look at what it's spent on, in many countries, over 85 or 90% of that spend goes to health workers, which is fine at one level, but that leaves very little fiscal fungibility for moving and purchasing other types of resources and allocating against best buy interventions. And so if you are, most of the growth of your system is through out-of-pocket spending, you're losing the opportunity of pooling that expenditure, increasing fiscal fungibility, and allocating your resources more around best buys. And I would argue that this is, for a development assistance and a development financing institution like a bank, a place where we have a very large agenda of improvement.
Great, thanks. So Steve, going to you, we're in a very different political environment than we have been before or expected, I think, to be in. And I'd really like to hear from you about what you see as the main ways or messages that are coming out of this report that could be used to inform those discussions, or are we just facing some hurdles that we might not be able to overcome with some of this important information?
So. Okay. I want to repeat the thanks to Joe for this, and congratulations to Joe and Chris and the team for this work. And Joe came by CSIS yesterday, and we recorded a terrific podcast in which he goes into considerable detail for about 40 minutes. We'll be posting that in a couple of days, so please look at that. Look to listen to that and take as directed. Second point is, you know, I wanted to know when I looked at this whether in 2040 health would account for 60 or 70% of the U.S. economy, and we would still be debating whether or not we should have universal health coverage. But we can debate that later. I was struck by these huge disparities. 47, I think, was the ratio, I think, at one point you cited, between the richest and the poorest in terms of spend. It really is, in that 25-year period, that low-income portion grows by 50% from 8% to 12%, with very, very little in expenditure, and it's a pretty dystopian vision for those 750 million people. I mean, it is high dependency. It's a ghetto that is remote and set off in a significant way from the rest of the world, and I think it's pretty alarming to see that projection. It's not the first time that your projections have sort of painted this picture of a widening disparity, but it does come through very very dramatically, and it raises the question of what are we going to do about this, or what action do you take that we haven't already thought about or taken in that context? In terms of the current situation we're in, I would argue that, in fact, we're at a very uncertain, dramatic moment that has been that is unprecedented. We had, as you've recorded, we had growth in the 90s of the development assistance account of 4 or 5%. We went into a very accelerated growth rate of 11%, 15% in terms of the U.S. In the naught decade, it's been relatively flat at 1.8% in that period. And now we're at a position where there has been, here in our context, if you look at the blueprint budget, the skinny budget, there's been a pretty dramatic populist assault upon the State Department, AID, the value of foreign assistance and the value of multilateral institutions. There has, as Jennifer has pointed out, there's been some caveats around four institutions: Global Fund, President's Malaria Initiative, Gavi, and PEPFAR. But we don't know what that really means. And what does this suggest? This suggests that this area has been targeted, along with EPA and a few other institutions, as institutions that are seen as particularly antithetical to an American first agenda, one where the transfer of resources out of those sectors into security is the fundamental transfer that's proposed. Now, that may not happen, given what we've heard from the Hill, but it does raise the specter that even if half of that, what is proposed, is accomplished in terms of cuts, the top line was 29%. When you look at the state and AID accounts, we're talking really about 31-32%. If even half of that is accomplished, and then it continues as a year-on, year-out impulse and logic of the way this particular administration wants to reorder its financing in a very narrow set of options it has for capturing resources and moving them into other sectors, if they're not going to tackle Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid, and there's only a 27% of the budget that can be targeted, it leaves you very little. And you've already targeted NIH. You're proposing to do away with the Fogarty International Institution, International Center. That is unprecedented. And I think it does raise the specter that you could have, as Jennifer was alluded, you could have successive years. Well, what happens if we have successive cuts? Then we're into a period of prolonged contraction. And the role of U.S. leadership over the last 25 years has been as a driver of growth, both in our own accounts, but in motivating others to come to the table. We've not been in a situation where you could have protracted contraction over multiple years, and we don't really know yet what the implications would be in terms of the behavior of other donors. We're seeing a little bit of that in terms of the populist convergence between London and Washington, and the announcement or the unwillingness to make a commitment, a recommit to the 0.7% of GDP and part of Theresa May's government. So I think we need to countenance that, and we need to, perhaps I think it would be very valuable if we did have scenarios that drew out multiple years, just in order to illustrate to congressional appropriators and authorizers what this truly might mean, because it is a possibility. I don't think I'm being alarmist in raising this prospect. Thank you.
I don't know if either of you want to jump in, or I have a couple.
Just 2 points. And I think, Steve, you're I think not unrealistic, but rather concerning prospects. Raised a very important issue, and I was I'm on the board of Gavi, and we had a retreat a couple of weeks ago, and I think one of the things that came out of that was, even though everybody who works in vaccines and immunization thinks that, you know, this is the silver bullet of development, and how could anybody in the world ever contest this, the biggest mistake Gavi could make is to take its constituency for immunization for granted. And so there, out of that came a very strong need to think about building demand and not to pretend, because you're doing health and saving lives, that everybody thinks that's a great idea, but actually to actively cultivate that community. Because, you know, if you don't, then it doesn't take much of a counterforce, and we've seen this in the area of vaccines and immunization, to erode that base of support. And health is actually a particularly good area, topic area for giving, you know, building that demand. But I think it really requires an active demand. The second is with respect to the disparities globally in health spend. I think if my president were here right now, he'd say that countering those disparities in expenditure are the fact that everybody's aspirations for what they achieve in health are converging around the highest level of health possible. And so this is going to create a massive political challenge for politicians in low-income countries where, you know, in Ethiopia, you call your taxi driver brother here in Washington and say, you know, what do I do for my chest pain? And they will give you what standard of care is at Georgetown or George Washington, and that expectation will be relayed back home. And we're already seeing this growth in aspirations come up. And so how this will be managed, I think, is also something that may also be a force for more political attention to growing domestic resources. Last thing that none of these analyses really get a good purchase on, and it's not a critique, it's just the reality of health accounts and as we understand them, is private sector expenditure. And I think we need to, beyond individual out-of-pocket, we need to get a better sense of what the opportunities are with respect to harnessing private sector expenditure much more systematically, and bringing that into the tent of understanding total health expenditure in countries, because that may be a much more tangible way of not only relying on growth in government expenditure, which tends to be slow. There may be some innovative ways of bringing in private expenditure to be much more part of the total health system.
So in this counter to the theme of doom and gloom, a couple of reflections there. First, we shouldn't forget that we are actually living through an extraordinary period of improving health everywhere. And in fact, what's really interesting to me is that we had two major reversals for health. One was the rise of mortality in Eastern Europe and Central Asia, post the collapse of the Soviet Union, a lot of it related to alcohol use. And what has gone somewhat unnoticed is that in the last 5 years, there's been a sharp drop in mortality in most of those countries, reflecting that those societies have sort of found a way to tackle their main health problems. And then the other big reversal is the HIV epidemic and their, you know, PEPFAR Global Fund. We can trace the causal route from development assistance to ART scale up and PMTCT scale up and you know, dramatic progress in the last 10 years on that front. So there's success stories both about development assistance but also about capacities of societies to eventually respond to health challenges. And when you put all that together over the last 25, 30, 40 years, it adds up to this just extraordinary leap in health outcomes that far exceeds the leaps, the progress in economic development. So useful to remember that, you know, we are living in this era of quite sustained progress and an indication that somehow societies find a way to tackle their biggest problems, or have done to date. And then that takes you to part two, which is, well, if development assistance is not going to go up and might well go down, what about the fiscal space or the potential of countries to spend more of their own resources? And in the prospective paper, and I think for time reasons, Joe didn't really spend a lot of time talking about it, there's this analysis of what is the fiscal space. And there is lots of potential if you went up to the level of either government spend that other countries have overall, or the fraction of government spend for health. There's lots of potential for the lower middle income and upper middle income countries. And so I think the dynamic around a world with less development assistance, potential in lower middle income and upper middle income countries, means that development assistance will need to focus on the low income, who just don't have the potential, and thinking about other levers or other mechanisms, maybe it's the bank, maybe it's other international institutions that can help persuade governments about the value of upping their own domestic commitment to help.
So Jen, just two things on that, and on the more positive side, as Chris is saying. We just had a meeting on tobacco taxation 2 days ago, and you know, one of the big picture messages coming out of that meeting is that if globally we put a dollar more tax per pack, we would decrease adult mortality by 6% globally and add $141 billion to government revenues. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, these government revenues are being put to purpose, to health purposes. So in the Philippines, for example, with their, what Sir George Alain has renamed their sin tax, it no longer their sin tax, but their virtue tax, which was a big tax on tobacco. They generated $3 billion over 3 years. And those monies were used to triple the number of beneficiaries for PhilHealth, the national health insurance. And so I think, one, there are ways in which we can be more innovative on managing significant increases in resources on things which are public health bads through some of these approaches to taxation. And we're seeing many, many, many countries adopt these hypothecated or excise taxes now. A second, though, and this is really important point that Chris finished on, we've found that as countries transition into middle income and have to think about borrowing at non-concessional terms or no longer being eligible for grants, that their appetite for social sector decreases very significantly. They don't want to borrow for health and education. They'll borrow for infrastructure, but not for health and education. And so what we've been doing, working with the Global Fund, for example, is looking at how we can buy down, the Global Fund can buy down the interest on an IBRD loan, which is a significant interest rate loan, and that buying down of the interest that the government would pay actually increases the interest of the government to borrow for the health sector. So we have projects now in Georgia and Vietnam, which are middle-income countries, whereby they are actually borrowing for health. And the benefit for the Global Fund is, instead of making a grant of $100 million to a middle-income country, which is tough for their development partners to justify, they can make a grant of $15 million and leverage $100 million of loan that the bank has put out. And that loan is actually on the government books. And so it's a form of domestic resource mobilization. And so I think part of what we're going to see increasingly is a shift in the nature of development assistance, so that we get a larger set of tools which go beyond the traditional grant financing and look at how we can leverage both loans and concessional and otherwise with these instruments like buy downs and guarantees and things like that.
Great. Actually, that was going to be one of my questions. And related to that, maybe this is a question for anyone, and or Steve as well, on the political opportunity here. One of the things that the U.S. government is stating that it's going to do, and I think is an important thing to do, is or many are saying should do, is evaluate how it's using its development assistance and its foreign aid. Evaluation is important. Assessing it is important. We could always do a better job, right? So if you look at the skinny budget, one of the things it talks about in there in terms of reductions is right-sizing the amount of assistance to by country. There's not criteria spelled out in there, but it occurs to me, and picking up on Tim's point about how this study, these studies help paint the bigger picture, there's a real story in the data about how you, if you have a limited amount of development assistance or a reduction, about targeting that assistance and really finding those countries that in the next 10, 20, through 2040 are going to still be at this bottom rung that will still need to rely on a much greater share of development assistance, while the others, and this is going to be another question for following up, the missing middle, can rely on other instruments, such as the ones that Tim is talking about. So what do you see, to any of you, how does that story get told outside of here, since the data becomes more of a policy story for the U.S. and other donors really trying to think ahead, and whether you call it right-sizing, adjusting, dealing with a new reality about what the next 20, 25 years of development assistance might mean?
Well, if you're taking USAID as a focus, you know, there's a number of options in the air at the moment, and in that sense, the moment might be ripe to appeal for there to be a more systematic evaluation around performance and data before major structural decisions are made. That is to pause and create some kind of advisory analytic effort rather than rush forward with actions that might wind up dismantling certain parts of this or doing away with entire accounts. We've said that four of the programs, two bilateral and two multilateral programs, have some measure of special sort of acknowledgement of their importance. The flip side of that is that family planning and reproductive health are acutely vulnerable, and climate change programs are acutely vulnerable. A number of other things are acutely vulnerable. And in that sense, if you could appeal for there to be a systematic evaluation, that might actually slow things down and bring about a more careful set of deliberations. I think it's important, obviously, to bring in Congress into this, because it's much of the deliberations around which direction we go is going to be determined by the decisions made there, and pulling them in on this would be quite important.
Anyone else?
I think Steve is pointing to some particular areas of concern, and we have evidence from a previous period when the U.S. government was particularly concerned about investments in sexual and reproductive health, and that legacy led to sharp rises in maternal mortality associated with absence of access to, you know, family planning and reproductive health services, which we need to bring out, because I think those sorts of things are strong arguments as to why this funding matters. The other part of it also is, and we saw this again, is that there's a relative mobilization in other constituencies, which is important. And we saw there's a meeting in Belgium in March, led by the Netherlands. And I think it's very important to recognize that it's not fully a commensurate response, but there's a rallying by the international community beyond the United States around this issue, which I think is also very important to respond to. But beyond a specific issue on with respect to development assistance for one area, I do think there are a couple of things that are going to be really important in terms of the low-income, most vulnerable countries. And the first is that, as we saw coming out of the meeting in Istanbul last year on the humanitarian summit, this linkage between humanitarian assistance and development is going to be increasingly important. And so to what extent can you take away sort of the acute relief exclusive focus of a lot of emergency support and start to build in efforts to lay the groundwork for development? And we've, at the World Bank, in our $75 billion IDA 18 replenishment, $14 billion has been set aside for really looking at how we can build a development lens and an action into investing in fragile environments. Now, the jury will be out. We haven't proven that we can, you know, blend that acute a humanitarian response with a medium to longer term development. But there is some evidence, for example, from Yemen, where we've got a terrible situation at the moment, but we together with partners, we invested $200 million in February, and by the end of March, we had 5 million children immunized. We had reestablished maternal child health services and things like that. So one, to see the rapid progress, but two, to recognize that these are essential health interventions that are being grafted into NGOs and the bits and pieces of government that can be worked with in those scenarios. So I think that's a particular and important area to focus on. The second is in all low-income countries, in the meeting that I left today, which is focusing on efficiency, all low-income countries could do much more with the resources they have. And I think this is an important thing, not only for ministers of finance in low-income countries, but also for development partners. So if in one fell swoop, by going into an electronic payment system for all your health workers, you can eliminate ghost workers in your country, and that sheds between 20 to 40% of the health workers on the payroll, that's a massive gain in fiscal space, which can really give you more health for the money. And so I think these are things that are being done, and this isn't fanciful. In the midst of the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone, we were finding that the number of emergency workers from the government were going up exponentially every day. And the payment system was brown bags full of cash. Not very easy to report on in terms of transparency and accountability. So with our governance folks at the bank, we instituted an e-payment system which was linked to real bank accounts. And the number of workers came down by almost two-thirds. And so those are the sorts of things where there are very few countries in the world that can't move to that immediately. And if you can show some quick wins on how you're getting more health for the money and stretching those dollars, then I think that builds confidence that that development partners will continue to need, that in fact, that health development is a best buy.
Okay, thanks. Unless any of you want to say anything more, I think we'll go to our questions from...
I just wanted to
Short
comments. You know, on the focus around evaluation, we should keep saying what we have been saying, but keep reminding the Hill and everybody else who has some influence on this, on the multiple success stories that are traceable to investments, whether it's measles, bed nets, or ART and PMTCT. And there's a twist to that story, which is we're seeing this year in the data that places, for example, where bed net distribution faltered, malaria has come back. I mean, these are
very sensitive outcomes to what we spend and what we do as a global community and obviously implement at the national level. Second observation is to Tim's point about efficiency, a little advertisement. I'll take Steve's podcast advertisement. May 18th, we have a new analysis, which is our first foray into looking at quality and access to care. And it'll be coming out in The Lancet, where we actually try to quantify over time and by country healthcare access and quality. And it gives you an endpoint to actually start to look at the personal healthcare part. It's not covering the public health part. To actually try to address a little bit more directly how much variation in efficiency there is. Because it's really hard if you look at something like life expectancy versus spend, because there's so many other factors that are going into life expectancy. And then the last comment is at the low income side, a theme that's come up in previous versions of this discussion, which is that there are actually some low income countries that don't get a lot of development assistance. Some of the Francophone African countries per capita get much less than others. And they, perhaps not surprisingly, turn out to be the ones that are going to remain low income in the future. And that imbalance just does need to be fixed if we're going to see more probability that they won't be low income in a generation.
Thanks. Okay, so we'll turn to questions. We're going to go for three at a time. Raise your hand. We have a couple folks with mics. So just let us know who you are, where you're from. We'll start over here. Yep.
Hi, Carl Hoffman from PSI. Thanks for the great report, as always. There are at least two great things that come out of IHME. One is this report. The other is the great work you do, of course, on global burden of disease. As you may remember, we use DALIs as a performance metric for PSI. I'm wondering if you can say a word about whether there's been an improvement in the match between development assistance for health and what kills and sickens us over the 8 years that you've been doing this report.
Okay, let's take two more. And Joe's not up here, but if you have a question for Joe, please add it in. Come over here, and then we'll go back there. Chris.
Yeah,
Chris.
Hi, thank you for this great work. I'm Chris Collins with Friends of the Global Fight. Just want to ask you a question about another potential dimension to this work, which is, you know, with infectious disease, where a lot of this money is going, obviously, there's also, as you can project out in time in terms of investments increasing or decreasing, you can also project out need changing in infectious disease, if you get ahead of it. If you invest and get programming out adequately to drive down incidence and, you know, other costs and costs associated, you can at some point eliminate the need for those investments. So I'm just wondering if, and then it's also true with those infectious diseases, the mix of low income to upper middle income countries is quite different, a whole nother dimension. So with TB, so much of it is in upper middle income, for example. So I'm just wondering if you can talk through what that might look like if you had an analysis that looked at potential to drive down financing need in the future, given that we can do that with infectious disease, and therefore the investment opportunity there. And then also whether it would be interesting to look by disease at the relative mix of low income versus upper income, et cetera, and what that means about need for investment and opportunity.
Hi, Susanna Guntoy from Africare. I have two questions. One is, where do you see the sort of the messaging around global health security fitting into the growth or encouragement to build on financing? And the second is, Germany is now leading, or holds the presidency in terms of the G20. And they have just announced that they would increase their spend significantly through 2020, I think. Where do you see the BMZ and the GTZ and their approach? I mean, just thinking about the fact that their approach also looks a little bit more sort of structurally at technical capacity building, and it's very different from the US and the UK type, and what influence could they have?
Great, thanks. Great questions. I'll turn it over to our panelists. Who wants to start with whichever of the ones you want to pick.
Well, let me take the GBD and the development assistance for health match. You know, I think with the expansion of spend on maternal and child health, or the share, you know, that there was a lot of burden there. That was good, improved the match. But the reality is that if you take burden, even in low-income or, you know, lower middle-income countries, as is, there's a huge burden already from non-communicable diseases. And there was the Council on Foreign Relations report about it. And so there is this enormous mismatch. Now, the question is that wrong or not, I think, is a more complicated one, which is, you know, if we focus on the low income because of age structure issues, it's still really dominated by maternal child health, HIV, TB, malaria. But as soon as you're into the lower middle income, you know, there is a poor match, and that hasn't changed because of that sort of fundamental question.
So let me make two comments on the second question around, first, and then the on infectious diseases, and then the other question on global health security. On infectious diseases, I think this is an area where we need to be thinking about, as some are, about what portion of development assistance for health should move into global public goods. Because it's absolutely clear that if we had a vaccine for HIV, then that would have a massive benefit for avoiding expenditure in the future on ARV treatment, right? And presumably PEPFAR, or the U.S. Would be very interested in that in terms of exit strategy. At the bank, we created an advanced market commitment to encourage accelerated development of pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. If we achieve universal immunization with pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, we can wipe out one of the highest residual causes of child mortality, which is pneumonia, or one cause of pneumonia, and also stem one of the growing threats with respect to antimicrobial resistance, because there'll be much less use for antibiotics. So I think looking at some of the public good or the externalities of particular types of interventions with respect to future spend in the system is going to be particularly important on that front. In terms of global health security, we're actually just about to release recommendations from an international working group on financing of preparedness that Peter Sands is chairing. And it's very interesting because although those who are in the global health security business have been advocating sort of siloed financing for global health security, when you look at what the spend is on following up on these things called joint external evaluations, which have assessed IHR, international health regulation, preparedness in countries, the large bulk of those expenditures move through the mainstream of the health system. And so, for example, if you're going to improve infection prevention control, you do that through health facilities. You don't create separate health security facilities for that, right? So, the direction or vector of the recommendations that we're making are to really acknowledge where you can make marginal increases in existing budget categories so that you cover security more effectively. So, for example, the way we're doing that in East Africa, where we support a whole regional laboratory capacity building effort in the East African community, we're looking at developing within those laboratories capacities for outbreak pathogens that they may or may not have at the moment, rather than creating a whole separate network, right? So that way the marginal financing is much more affordable and palatable than thinking that you need to have an entirely separate specific type of financing for that. On BMZ and G20, you're absolutely right. Germany is now the second largest development financier in the world. And this is, I think, incredibly encouraging. And also the way in which they're looking at it, tomorrow with Ingrid Hoven, who's the head of BMZ, will be launching a paper on universal health coverage, which looks at what are those core systems functions related to financing, supply chain, information, health workers that need to be supported so that countries have that core systems infrastructure to help them deal with their multiple health challenges. That's a different approach, and it may not go down well in the United States, but Germany has been very consistent and growing their support for this, and so we don't have to sell development the same way in all places.
2 points. On the health security question, I do think this is an area where it's possible to get some traction with the Trump administration, with Congress, for a couple of reasons. One, I think there's been a shift of consciousness as to the need for a continuous investment in preparedness and in the capacities within our own government following SARS, Ebola, pandemic flu, Zika, and some of the embarrassments that we've experienced there. And it's reflected in some of the early actions in preserving within the White House the staffing and hiring in some new senior level folks on the health security front. It's a broad umbrella, I think, in which you can fold a number of different things, including innovation, R&D, the DOD and civilian capacities. The administration's legislatively on the hook to rewrite its biodefense strategy this year by September, and that's going to cover a lot of ground. And we've got right in our neighborhood a meltdown state in terms of Venezuela that has hemispheric implications. We've got a lot of attention focused on North Korea. So there's a number of different ways in which this agenda comes into play, I think, on a day-to-day basis, reminding us. Now, the global health security agenda, it's not clear how that will be carried forward, but I don't think it's been politicized to the degree that it will be cast aside as an Obama creation for that simple reason. I don't think that's going to happen. The Ebola emergency supplemental money, the billion, now $1.2 billion in emergency funds for capacity building in the 17 primary countries, that money will be spent out by the end of this year, by the end of this calendar year. So it begs the question of, is there going to be continuous funding? In the blueprint budget was a proposal for contingency funding on response, not on capacity building, but on response. I think that contingency proposal has bipartisan support. It's reflected, it's something that candidates across the spectrum were calling for that. On the question around allies, I think it's going to be terribly important that the Japanese, the Germans, the British, the Canadians, the French be engaging on the value, the continued centrality of foreign assistance in this period. On health, you have the Japanese health minister arriving here in early May with a very senior level delegation visiting with Secretary Price, NIH, CDC, industrial. You have David Nabarro, a UK candidate here for the World Health Organization Director General's position. I think having the British government behind the leadership will help move Washington in that regard. And you've got Canada and France lined up to be chairing the G7 following Italy, and there's the opportunity for continuing to engage. And I think on all of those fronts, the Germans remain central and, across the board on that, and I think their leadership has been remarkable.
Great, so let's take 3 more questions. Lots of questions. Somebody up here, then back there, and then we'll go over there. So here, middle, back, and then on the side. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Jason Bremner from Family Planning 2020. And I guess my question is not about family planning, but it's about the domestic health spending. A little bit of a holy grail. I'm asked to track family planning spending and to look at government spending. And we have a really hard time at getting more particular account by account spending from domestic expenditures. And I wonder If you have any insight on that, what's the way forward? What are the systems that we needed to work on as a global health community to unpack the growth in domestic health spending that's expected?
Great.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm Janet Fleischman with the CSIS Global Health Policy Center. And this may be for Tim. I wonder if you could give us an update on where the Global Financing Facility fits into all this. A relatively new financing mechanism focusing on reproductive, maternal, newborn, child, adolescent health. And I know that there's meetings now for this coming days at the spring meetings at the bank. And maybe you can give us a sense of what you think and see going forward.
Great. And our last question for this round, over here.
Hi, I'm Lucy Mize. I'm the head of the health team for USAID's Asia Bureau. And I have two questions. When we work with our counterparts, they raise two concerns that you haven't yet touched on. You haven't touched on the growing aging population in Asia, and the impact on services, and the growing urbanization and the millions of uncounted in urban slums who need access to healthcare. So could you comment on what you think those two trends will, what impact they'll have on your forecasted spending? Thanks.
Thanks. Okay. Domestic resource mobilization, particularly subsector specific, GFF and aging and urbanization trends. And you were looking at Joe. Did you want him to
jump in? I think
I'm
the family planning one, tracking that. Do you want to comment, Joe?
You can speak into there.
Great. So I think regarding the question about tracking government spending by health focus area, there's just a dearth of that information. It's not available. The little bit of data that does exist are from kind of different pockets. And what I think needs to happen, and work that really should be happening, and I think we're keen to be a part of happening, is taking the disparate tracking and putting it together into a systematic, kind of well-understood perspective, and taking data from the system of health accounts, which more and more is tracking spending, government spending in particular, by disease, but also combine it with the other estimates that exist. And much like the global burden of disease philosophy, that everything has to add up and kind of fit systematically and comprehensively, that same process needs to happen for the financing. So right now, my recommendation is that there's a lot of disparate data sources that I think people are trying to grab a hold of and put together. What I think needs to happen is some sort of systematic approach. And that's certainly work that IHME is looking to the future, recognizing needs to happen.
So. Great, thanks.
So I just want to supplement to Joe's answer. I think this is an area for family planning where you've got to get a better sense of what's going on in the private sector, because there's a lot of spend going on, especially with respect to family planning, which isn't being captured in the public accounts and won't be. On GFF, this is a global financing facility for every woman, every child. We launched this in Addis Ababa, the Financing for Development meeting in July of 2015, almost 2 years ago. And the facility is really looking at shifting the paradigm in development finance around domestic resource mobilization. And so the GFF is looking at how development assistance with a trust fund associated with the GFF, but that leverages our IDA resources, those are our very concessional financing for low-income countries, and other development partners' resources around country plans to scale up interventions, Best Buy interventions for every woman, every child. We deliberately put this, designed this around every woman, every child, because we know that there will always be women and children who need health services. And although we may conquer diseases, if you set up a system that guarantees or can provide that universal entitlement to women and children, then you've got the NIDAS for a system that will be truly universal. And when we look back over time, as we have in a case study of 24 countries that have moved towards universal health coverage, many of them started by guaranteeing that universal entitlement to every woman and every child. So our focus on domestic resource mobilization is in an alliterative three S's: smart, scaled and sustainable financing. And smart financing, because we say you can get more health for the money by looking at how to get best buys and best delivery. Scaled, if you're only financing your health system at 25% or 40% of what's needed, you're not going to get to every woman, every child. So how do you diminish that gap in what's required for full financing? Understanding what the growth in the child health cohort is every year, and very few health systems are growing their budgets in step with the growth in the child health cohort. So this is where we're really putting a big focus on growing resources, and finally on sustainable financing, looking at how development assistance is actually supporting the development of those institutions that we know are going to secure financing in the longer term. Very explicitly, how do we move to prepayment institutions, either through more tax or by innovative ways of getting the informal sector included in prepayment systems? And a lot of work to be done there, but if we can get that done properly in some countries, then we'll begin to move the financing capacity of those countries in such a way that they can grow with the aspirations and expectations of their populations for universal entitlement.
So on the aging question, thank you. That's a great lead into telling you that what Joe is presenting on forecasted health spend is actually part of a much larger forecasting program of work that we have at IHME. So we will start producing and releasing later this year comprehensive forecasts of all the risks and all the diseases in the GBD, different scenarios. And so, you know, there's a lot in there about what is the consequences of aging. We've actually been asked by other organizations in the next iteration to try to explicitly address urbanization, including from I think the bank and your the chief economist's interest in urbanization. And so we will have a lot of essentially new analytics that will be coming. And you know, we're very happy that we have, you know, at least 10 more years of work that's financed already, especially in this era, to produce both the finance work and this GBD and the forecast work.
Great. Actually, that's great to know about the future projections that you're going to be looking at, because linking it, Chris Collins is gone, but his question, I think, gets at a really good point to connect those future forecasts of potential health changes to the financing inputs and what some different scenarios might be if financing goes up, financing goes down. The mix is different. What's the cost of not doing business now for later, which I think is what Chris was getting at. We have time for two very quick questions. So I'm going to ask two people who are lucky last two to be quick. We have somebody up here, and then we have someone over there.
Hi, thanks. I'll make it fast. I'm Terry Ford from AIDS Healthcare Foundation. It's for Tim. Middle-income countries like Mexico and Ukraine have to pay up to 10 times more, as you know, for antiretrovirals and TB medications than low-income countries. What's the World Bank doing about that inequity? And why won't the World Bank just release a strong statement saying that the classification system should not be used for aid decisions and drug pricing decisions? Thanks.
And our last question.
I'm Sarah Overmull. I'm a healthcare reporter with S&P. Mr. Evans, you talked a lot about private sector spending, kind of incentivizing the expenditure there. So I wanted to ask you what you meant by that about creating market demand and stuff, and then how, in general, that sits with the other panelists, if private sector can really step up and fill in some of these things and how it can.
Okay.
It's on you, Tim.
All right, great. Joe? First, on the issue of prices for HIV and TB drugs, it's clear that pool procurement opportunities are ways in which you can get a drug vaccine prices down. And there's the Global TB Drug Facility, which has tried to do that, I think, quite successfully. And so those benefits are ones that countries can avail themselves of, but they have to be part of a mechanism to do that. We work with the Global Fund as well as Gavi, and pool procurement, I think, is part of what they try and offer as part of their market shaping value added. And I think Gavi's probably a little stronger overall than and the Global Fund in that function. But in terms of the bank, there is a perception, and it's a misperception, that somehow because we have an updated classification of economic development which stratifies countries according to low, middle, and upper income, that somehow we're advocating this as a basis for deciding eligibility. Within the bank, when we're looking at what constitutes IDA eligibility, which is our concessional financing, we actually don't use that classification exclusively. Well, the Global Fund uses that, but it also uses burden of disease. And so, you know, and so does Gavi. So what we have been offering as part of the governance structures of those is an understanding of, one, that those lines perhaps aren't the best way to make distinctions in terms of eligibility for financing from those institutions, but rather can contribute insights along with other things. And the bank also publishes something called the CPIA, which gives some sense of the institutional capacity in countries. And so I think what we've been trying to do on in our role as a board member in both Gavi and the Global Fund is to bring a little bit more sensitivity to issues in addition to burden of disease and distributional issues in terms of need to bear in thinking about continued eligibility. But as I mentioned earlier, some of the buy-down options that we're working with the Global Fund are ways in which you can address ways of continuing support which are a little bit more compatible with what donors are prepared to give to middle-income countries. On the private sector question, let me give you one example. And I think this is really important because my experience living in developing countries is the health system, if you think about it in both the beyond the government sector, doesn't wait for the government sector. And so let me just focus on one specific example in terms of health professional training. If you look at the growth in tertiary education opportunities for doctors, nurses, nurse midwives in most countries, the growth in those education institutions is in the private sector in the last 10 years. And so the question is not whether there should be a private sector investment. There is. The question is that private sector investment actually meeting real needs? Is it providing, is it producing quality nurses, midwives, or doctors? And there, I think, we're perilously taking our eye off the ball. And it relates to some sense that it's only the public sector that trains health professionals, when in reality, this market is robust, emerging. There are venture financiers that are actively engaged in this, and they're making a lot of money. So the question for us is not to ignore it. How do you embrace it and make sure that it's part and parcel of the bigger health system and being seen as a collective asset, rather than something which is ripping off students, producing poor quality workers, et cetera, et cetera?
Okay, I'm going to ask if Steve has something to sure.
Sure. So I was only giving you one example. And so there are multiple entry points. So when we break up the private sector into the various ways in which it comes into the health sector, for example, the information industry dimensions, or as you're saying, the pharmaceutical manufacturing, massively important. When I was in Pakistan 2 weeks ago, I was speaking with the chief minister of Punjab. He said, you know, this country has a 6 million child cohort every year. We're going to produce our own vaccines. Right? And they'll do it through the private sector. And in 10 or 15 years, I'm sure they will. So what I'm saying is when we look at the private sector, we have to break out of a public sector only mindset. Public sector has massively important functions, but we have to look in a granular way at the various ways in which the private sector is active and will be active, and work with that in ways that are going to address burden of disease in cost-effective manners.
Okay, since we are at time, I'm going to see if Steve wants to say anything really quickly and then give Chris and IHME the final word because of all the amazing work they're releasing today.
Just one final thought, which is I really don't think when we're talking about health in lower-income countries, I don't think there's much substitution for U.S. leadership in this period. In other words, I think if there's a serious contraction, it's going to be very hard to see other donors in private sector compensating for that in any imaginable way that's appropriate or adequate. And you know, 2/3 of the dollars spent today on HIV/AIDS in donor money is coming from the United States, just as one illustration of vulnerabilities that we face. So just I would close with that one thought. There's really no adequate substitution for U.S. sustained U.S. leadership.
Just to reinforce the theme that Joe said at the very beginning, which is something we really believe strongly at IHME, which is the way to get the best measurement, we believe measurement can change outcome, is to get the world's expertise engaged, to get engagement in all the relevant countries. On the global burden of disease side, we now have 2,300 collaborators in 133 countries, and that's growing every day. And we imagine and hope that the work that Joe leads on finance will grow in a similar way. So just to reinforce that we would really like people to not only use the results we have, but get engaged in their production. So thanks.
Great, thank you. So please join me in thanking our panelists and IHME and Joe.